The MOU that is MIA, the Memorandum of Understanding with Iran, turns 60 days old today. And its ballyhooed diplomatic promises, nowhere to be found. Violent crime is down nationwide. I mean, way down. The murder rate is at a 20-year low. Why? How? Who deserves credit? We're going to try to find out. Now, you have never asked this question, but I counted up the total number of emojis I regularly use. 9. The number is 9. Do they signify my age? Probably everything else about my life does. Here's a more important topic for you. What do your emojis say about you? Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. 60 days ago, the world thought it might see its way clear of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. That's when the Memorandum of Understanding went into effect, and with it, anticipation of the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz and a path towards substantive negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. There was momentary euphoria, diplomatic and economic, about what might come to pass. Well, in the end, not much has. The Strait remains choked, mostly. World oil prices remain elevated, mostly. And thus, inflation, persistent, mostly. Diplomatic and economic nerves remain frayed. President Trump said today he will not seek an extension of the MOU, and that leaves the region, to put it mildly, in limbo. By all outward appearances, the Iranian regime is digging in for a long test of wills with the Trump White House. Politically, this appears to be taking a toll. A new Reuters-Ipsos poll finds Trump's approval rating at 33%, a new low in his second term for that particular survey. The poll also found 80% of those surveyed expect the war with Iran to continue, quote, for an extended period of time. Bad news for Republicans who have stood with Trump and relied on his ability to bring the war to a swift conclusion with demonstrable strategic gains. And we're going to begin there tonight with senior national security correspondent Charlie Daggett. As we were discussing, Charlie, it was a big, busy weekend in the region, busy weekend on pronouncements from the president. Where are we?
Well, I mean, we'll start with the MOU. First of all, what even was it? There are several ceasefire violations, including ceasefire violation that ended up resulted in the deaths of U.S. troops while I was in the Middle East in Jordan. There's no sort of magical time where they ring the bell and return to full combat. It gave them an opportunity to extend that ceasefire. That doesn't look anywhere within the realm of possibility where we are today. And over the weekend, there were so many pronouncements coming out of Central Command, who in charge of that region, most importantly, Admiral Brad Cooper, who visited the Lincoln, made a point of it, right? They immediately sent out videos showing there he was, meeting with the troops, landing on the helicopter. And then another statement that came out in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed, again, reinforcing what they're doing for the well-being of troops. And then another statement. I'm on the phone to these guys all the time, like yesterday afternoon. Oh, we're going to release another statement, all along the same lines. And I don't want to be deeply cynical about this, because when it comes to especially a command, the number one responsibility is the well-being of forces.
Of course.
So it doesn't look good on them anyway. So they need to be seen to be making an effort, whether or not the conditions on the Lincoln were over-exaggerated, as Secretary Hegseth has said. Regardless, they have to be shown to be doing something about that.
Charlie, there's an operational tempo to war. There's also an operational tempo to communications and actions.
Oh, yeah.
And what we've seen in the last 72 hours is a dramatic uptick in operational tempo to address some of the concerns that were expressed in press reports about conditions on the Lincoln. That's a fact.
Major, look, I've been doing this for a long time.
I know you have.
And longer than I like to admit. I've never seen anything like what I've seen in the past 72 hours in terms of comms, getting that out. So that might suggest they had addressed something that was going on here. And I know they've come down hard on the media. We've been reporting it, and others have too. But remember that the genesis of this came from parents and came from spouses. Speaking to the Secretary of the Navy, the acting Secretary of the Navy.
On board the Lincoln.
To their Navy, exactly. And getting these stories back. And that is where it began. And we started digging into it. And I have to tell you, it hasn't been really easy. It's not like we're trying to be insidious about getting onto the sailors and Marines on the Lincoln. That's not it at all. Most of what we're getting is information from parents and spouses and loved ones who are concerned. A lot of these folks are on their first deployment.
Right. Yeah,
9-10 months we're going into now in the next few days? Straight into
and
a combat zone?
And to me, it was interesting, Charlie, when it was said by Central Command that they were going to be sending more additional support for mental health-related stresses on board that vessel.
Exactly.
That tells me that there is some understanding that what was being reported was at least true enough that more resources were necessary.
And, you know, it's no secret, and certainly my social media has been full of veterans and others saying, look, this is war. This is what it takes. If they were soldiers in the field or, you know, out in foxholes, they'd be dealing with this kind of hardship. This isn't that bad. And we do know, and this is something that Admiral Cooper has shared, the Lincoln did suffer in the early days. They had they were suffering from plumbing issues and resupply, et cetera. And now what we're seeing is sort of the mental strain and physical strain of what happens when you've got a carrier at sea for that long. That just comes with the property of being on a carrier. But as you said, they're plowing a lot of attention into this and making sure we all know about it.
And the context for this, of course, Charlie, is a war or a conflict, the president said, would be about 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks duration. We are long past that. Charlie Daggett, thanks so very much. CBS News national security analyst Aaron McClain joins me now here on the other side of the family table. He, of course, is also host of School of War podcast. Aaron, pick up on what we were just talking about. From your vantage point, the relevance of this conversation about lengthy deployment stresses on personnel in the region.
Well, let's talk about how it affects the strategy of the war itself. Iran can watch our television. It can read our newspapers. It understands, to an extent, American politics. If you're the Iranians making decisions, what are you thinking about? You're thinking about the midterms. You're locked in a kind of stalemate now. The Iranians fired their equivalent of a nuclear bomb by taking control of the Strait of Hormuz, or at least attempting to. The Americans seem to be getting some degree of oil out of the strait. And here we are, locked in. So the more political pressure the Iranians can bring to bear, the more they can do to humiliate the Trump administration. The Trump administration extends itself by saying Iran's military capabilities are destroyed. So anytime the Iranians can land any kind of blow, that's bad for the Trump administration. The more they can do to pile on, the better they improve their odds that the Congress or other American political forces will force a defeat for the Trump administration.
And Aaron, evaluate what I said at the top, because it reflects what you and I have discussed and what a lot of people are writing, that the Iranian regime, though it was fragile in the earliest days of this conflict, the top tier eliminated, the next tier eliminated, now appears to be reconsolidating itself in many different layers and digging in. And that means digging in externally toward the United States and other Gulf nations, and internally against any dissent.
The cadre is currently in charge of Iran, a lot of whom come from, a lot of whom are in the IRGC, are unlikely to be deterred by generalized economic pain imposed on the Iranian people by this blockade. They are in this to win it. And that's the fundamental mismatch here. That's why we are in this stalemate on some level, is that the Trump administration, Donald Trump, wants a deal. He wants some reset of U.S.-Iranian relations. He wants to deal with rational actors who will agree to move on with him in some new arrangement that favors both parties.
And to your word, revolutionary regime cadres. They are ideologically all in.
They want America out of the Middle East. That is victory for them. They want control of the strait. And they will not accept an arrangement that provides Trump a fig leaf. And so Trump can't walk away as a consequence of that, at least for now. And here we are. We're stuck.
There was an odd social media post from the president in that, or an interview rather with Fox, reinforced on social media, that the United States might bomb Oman, which is negotiating with the Iranians about potential safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz, which, if I remember correctly, the Memorandum of Understanding allowed for in paragraph 5.
That's right.
What should we make of this idea that we're going to bomb Oman?
I think it's unlikely that we're going to bomb Oman. I'll go out on a limb and say that. You can have me back and make
Charlie,
fun of me.
Charlie, you can nod your head and agree on that.
Charlie will report when it happens.
Charlie will say, yes, yes. Charlie's like, no, we ain't doing that. We're not saying it's going to happen.
But the fundamental tension that causes the president to make comments like this goes back to what we were saying. Oman and Iran are talking about how to manage the strait. Every report we get about what that arrangement could look like involves Iran imposing some level of control over the strait.
Extracting some sort of financial payment concession fee of some kind.
Highly likely in the long run, I would say. And even more importantly than that, having controls, getting to say who goes and who doesn't go. In any of these discussions, have we heard that it's guaranteed the U.S. Navy gets to sail through the Strait of Hormuz at the end of this? I'd say that's pretty important to the prestige of the Trump administration and the security of the region. It's not been addressed in any of these arrangements.
Very quickly, before I let you go, Aaron, and Charlie, weigh in on this if you feel the need to. When the president says we're not going to extend, I don't feel a need to extend the memorandum of understanding, where does that leave us?
The memorandum of understanding, I think you said that it was MIA in your intro. It was kind of DOA, Major. Like, it didn't last more than a couple of days. Mm. So it's not, what would we be extending? We're extending something that's been a dead letter for at least 6 weeks.
Yeah, well, exactly that. And I think what this introduces is a new unpredictability. We were already
there. That's what I'm driving at.
But because that window is now shut, now we've gone into the twilight
zone. And everyone in the region knows it now. And they're going to start making their own bets. And when you make different bets in the region, you look out for number one, which is not necessarily the Trump administration.
And you have both sides of this fight that have been preparing for a return to full combat. The Iranians have, and so have the United States, in rearming munitions and moving those around, ready to go back to the fight.
Charlie Daggett, Aaron McClain, thank you so much. I appreciate it. CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Cordes joins us now. Well, Nancy, we went around and around the table here. What is the perspective on what we were just discussing from the White House?
Well, the president said today, Major, that the Iranians want a deal, that he's got all the time in the world. So, you know, depending on the day, sometimes the president will say that a deal is very close at hand. Sometimes he'll say he's got plenty of time. He's in no hurry. Today was one of those days where he said that he's in no hurry. He claimed that there were back channel talks going on with the IRGC. The Iranians were very quick to come out and knock that down and say there are no conversations going on between the U.S. and Iran.
And Nancy, also a pronouncement from the president about joint military exercises, South Korea and the United States, and a scaling back of those because the president displeased with the South Korean government.
Yes. Well, as you know from covering President Trump's first term, Major, there are a couple of things that really bother President Trump and have for a long time. Number one, he believes that the U.S. spends too much money to protect the South Koreans or conduct operations with the South Koreans or provide military equipment to them. He took a very different view in the first term than, say, the Biden administration, which felt that it was very important to build up relationships with countries like South Korea or Australia because that would help contain China. President Trump believes he can negotiate with China directly and handle that threat. So that's number one. Number two is he clearly is holding a grudge about the fact that the South Koreans, along with many other nations in the world, weren't quite interested in getting involved in the Iran war and didn't come running when he said he'd like outside help to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, for example. And so he brought that up again today. And that's all before you consider the sort of on-again, off-again fascination that President Trump has long held for the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Today, he claimed that he had heard from Kim Jong-un and that they were going to communicate or get together or have some kind of interaction soon. It's not clear exactly what that would look like, so we'll have to wait and see if that actually happens.
Another one of the wait-and-see events to come at the Trump White House. Nancy Cordes, I know you'll be there. Thank you very much. We're going to turn now to Florida. It will be primary day tomorrow. Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz is seeking a 12th term in Congress by running in a newly drawn House district, the 20th. And she faces some measure of criticism for choosing a predominantly black district to run in for re-election. I want to bring in CBS News Miami investigative reporter Jim DeFede. He is also the host of their Sunday morning public affairs program known as Facing South Florida. Jim, I'm always happy to have you. You are so dialed in on all things Florida politics. Let's start with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the 20th district, and I believe it's four others running against her, all African Americans. What's the state of that race?
Well, it looks pretty good for Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's feeling pretty comfortable. Really, there was, you know, the other four candidates, African-American candidates, including the former Congresswoman Sheila Shiflett McCormick, met several times before the deadline to see if they could galvanize around one of them. But for whatever reasons, nobody could agree that the others would have been better off. So as a result, you ended up in this situation. This is very much like what happened with Steve Cohen, if you remember 10 years or so ago in Memphis, where he ran in a majority black district or a largely minority district and was able to win because he kept running against minority candidates. Debbie Wasserman Schultz prides the fact that she is a longtime serving member of Congress. She wanted to protect that. She had the option of running in another district, a neighboring district that would have been tougher for her, but she chose this one and she's hoping that it'll pay off tomorrow.
Quick reminder to the audience, Florida redrew its maps, and that's why this situation has been set in motion. Talk to me about Corey Mills, who is a Republican running for re-election, does not and will not get the endorsement of the outgoing Governor Ron DeSantis because of his many ethical issues.
Yeah, he's facing an ethics investigation. He's been, accused by former girlfriends of abuse, another sort of restraining order against him. And Donald Trump had previously, back in February, endorsed Corey Mills. And there was a lot of calls, including from Laura Loomer and others, for the president to withdraw that endorsement. He didn't do that. But just the other day, he did repost his endorsement of everyone he liked in Florida, and he just didn't include Corey Mills in that one. So he didn't reaffirm it, but he didn't withdraw it either. And so we're going to see. That's going to be a close race. He's actually running and being challenged on the Republican side by a former TV news anchor, and we'll see how he ends up doing.
Talk to me about the governor's race. Byron Donalds, the likely Republican nominee, and David Jolly, possibly the likely Democratic nominee. How does that race stand at present?
Well, just look at the dollars and cents. Byron Donalds has raised more than $99 million for his campaign compared to David Jolly, who has raised less than $6 million. Florida is an expensive state, as you know, and so as a result, that's going to be a tough fight. David Jolly believes, though, that there is an opening for him, and you can expect to see a lot of conversation about data centers in Florida. Byron Donalds has made some statements about how he wants to open up pristine land in Florida, you know, to data centers. That is not a popular view in Florida. He's had to walk that back, but expect David Jolly to force that as an issue in this upcoming campaign, as well as the cost of living here and the fact that Florida has had about 30 years of Republican rule. And so if people are unhappy with the status of things, then they may want to seek something different. I'll also note that polling shows that Donald Trump is underwater in Florida, not by a lot, not by as much as you see in other states, but he is underwater in terms of his approval rating.
And Jim, very quickly, I've seen the polling gyrating a lot on that governor's race. Where do you think things currently stand?
I do think, are you talking about on the Republican side? On the Republican side,
in the general election, Donalds versus Jolly.
Everyone I've talked to, both Republican pollsters privately as well as Democrats, say they do think it could be a single-digit election. Now, to remind people, in 2022, Ron DeSantis won the state for governor by 19 points. That's a little deceptive. It's one of the reasons why people believe Florida is a deep blue state or deep red state. But the reality is what really happened in 22 was you had Democrats just stay home, just did not vote. Will they be turned on to actually come out in 26 in the general election? I think it's a much more likely scenario that for Democrats to turn out. Is it a double digit blowout? Probably not. But is it a single digit race? Yes. And it could get interesting depending on the issues.
$99 million for Donald, $6 million for David Jolly. That is a ratio to keep in mind. Jim DeFede, thank you very, very much. Still to come, how Americans, according to our newest poll, view socialism and free market economies. And our American economy writ large, CBS News Executive Director of Elections and Surveys, Anthony Salvanto, will run the numbers for us. Also, violent crime in the United States, way down. Why? I'll speak with an expert who says, well, there are lots of reasons, and we'll go through some of them. Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear says he has, quote, heard absolutely nothing from Senator Mitch McConnell. Our political panel reacts to that and a lot more. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. Democratic voters and lawmakers are split on how and if socialists should be welcomed into the Democratic Party. Here's how Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, also a Democrat, addressed this on Face the Nation.
People are struggling. They're struggling because the cost of groceries is too high. The cost of gas is too high. It's too hard to see a doctor, and when you do, the cost of that is too high as well. Now, I believe socialism is a failed experiment, but I do believe that we need to get results for the American people. And I think when you look at Democratic governors, you see those results.
I want to bring in CBS News Executive Director of Elections and Surveys, your friend and mine, Anthony Salvanto. All right, Anthony, what do Democrats think about socialism and how do they define it? Or how does our survey population in general define socialism.
Yeah, because all of this is kind of a fight in these primaries about what kind of economic message the Democrats are going to offer in the midterms. Start with this. This is your views among the American public. Socialism as a label is underwater. Capitalism is above water among the public, rated more favorably. But let me show you that among Democrats. And that is socialism gets relatively higher positive views and capitalism more negative among Democrats. That's your start. But in terms of then, what do the Democrats offer going forward? Because that's really what this debate is about. Well, consider this. When we asked people, look back on the last time Democrats were in power, were their economic policies successful? They're underwater on that. 54% not successful. So the argument's going to be, do they need to offer something new? And then you put in perspective here what it is that Democrats say it's important for their party to do on economic issues. And they say they should be advancing what they would consider big changes, even if harder to do. So you put all that together, and that's one side of the argument. The other one, though, comes back to what I just described for you, which is that most Americans think, besides being positive on capitalism, that the free market is good for the economy. So that's the contours of that argument, Major.
What about the generational differences among Democrats on this central question?
Yeah, this is so interesting. Take a look at this. Views of socialism among Democrats, much higher among Democrats with college degrees. One perspective on this is that there's kind of a relative expectations in that they do have higher incomes, they are doing a little bit better, and yet there's this sense among Democrats and among the general public that their opportunities are worse than the previous generation. So it may be that these folks feel like they're doing a little better, but quite simply, their money doesn't buy what they expected it to. And that part, frankly, we see not just in this poll, but we've also seen that in the vote patterns in some of these primaries, where some of those votes for folks more on the left have come from those kinds of areas. And that's part of the dynamic here, certainly worth watching.
Anthony Salvanto, always appreciated, sir. Thank you. Coming up, actor Hayden Panettiere dies at age 36, a tragedy echoing through legions of her fans. What we know about that so far. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Here's a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening, and I promise to do it better this time. Actor Hayden Panettiere died Sunday in an apartment in South Carolina. Among her most notable roles, the football movie, Remember the Titans, the sci-fi series Heroes, and the TV drama Nashville. The coroner's office said an autopsy completed today found no signs of trauma, and investigators have ruled out foul play. Panettiere had been open and quite vulnerable about her struggles off screen. In 2022, she discussed an addiction to opioids and alcohol. Panettiere would have turned 37 this Friday. The Supreme Court, for a second and final time, has declined to hear President Trump's appeal to a 2023 jury verdict that found him liable for sexual abuse and defamation involving E. Jean Carroll. Last month, Carroll received more than $5.6 million from Trump over this set of court decisions. The president and the Justice Department are also asking the High Court in a separate matter to throw out a second verdict for 2024, totaling $83 million in damages to Carroll. Violent crime rates plummeted in the United States in 2025. This is new data from the FBI's annual crime report. The report, which compiles crime data from roughly 87% of the U.S. police department, shows an overall 18% decrease in the murder rate as compared to the previous year. The annual murder rate tied, believe it or not, with 1955 and 1956 for the lowest on record since we began compiling this data starting in 1930. For more on this, Adam Gelb joins me now. He is president and CEO of the Council on Criminal Justice, an independent and nonpartisan think tank in this space. Adam, I'm grateful to have you with us here. So these are good news. These are good trend lines. They have been going on for the better part of 3 years, as I understand it. And we often in America grasp or reach for one single explanation, but I'm guessing there isn't one.
That's a good guess, Major. It's very good to be with you. Thanks for focusing on this. Before we jump into the whys, I think we've got to pause for a minute and just take additional note of how astonishing this is. You just ran through some of the numbers, but and now you've got them on the screen. We don't usually see things move like this in the criminal justice world. If you get a 7 or an 8% drop in a crime type in a given year, that's impressive. And we're seeing double-digit reductions across the map. We had this largest decline ever in a single year last year in homicide. And we actually track back to 1900 using both law enforcement and health data. And you heard the president say this in his remarks the other day, that we have now the lowest homicide rate we've seen since 1900. And the data that you're showing in there, we're talking about, goes through last year. At the Council on Criminal Justice, we've been taking snapshots every half year, and the one we just published shows that we're continuing to see additional double-digit declines through the first half of 2026. So it's really astonishing.
Okay, that is something to take on board and say this is such good news because it speaks to a safer public citizenry, less harm being done, less stress on the prison system, less stress on the prosecutors, all of it good trend lines. What are some of the reasons we can say with some confidence are contributing to this rather?
Right. Major, the more confidence somebody gives you with their answer, the more skeptical I am of it. What we're seeing right now is everything, everywhere, all at once, just like the title of the movie. We have drops that are occurring across the map. In cities, large, medium, and small, in cities that have very different political leadership and governance philosophies, different public safety strategies, different housing and economic conditions, and certainly very different levels of federal enforcement activity. So when you have all this happening everywhere all at once like this, it's darn near impossible to disentangle. Now, that said, for those of us who pay attention to this and follow it closely, I want to offer you three big buckets of things that are happening. One is big swings in criminal justice strategies. That includes these federal enforcement actions. It includes some of the gun enforcement actions by the Biden administration when this homicide drop started back in 2022. It includes significant expansion of community violence intervention programs where people who have been involved in gang violence convince others to take a different path with their lives. We're also seeing in the second bucket big swings in crime fighting and life-saving technologies, everything from this vast surveillance network that's been created by both government surveillance cameras as well as everybody's phones and their Ring cameras. I mean, you can't practically go anywhere in public right now without being caught on camera. If you talk to the public health folks, you'll hear that there have been significant advances in emergency medical care, and we have tracked in our own data some large drops in lethality, right? So we're seeing a drop in assaults, but a much bigger drop in homicides, which means the lethality of the violence is dropping. And then last and certainly not least is a big bucket of things, big shifts that are happening in society and culture. And I'll just name a few here. People are drinking way less alcohol in a move generally to healthier lifestyles. And when people drink less, they're less likely to get in fights. And another one that I just find fascinating, Major, is that that kids are spending, as we well know, a lot more time home alone scrolling their phones. And that has been terrible, as we know, for isolation and depression, other really terrible outcomes for adolescent mental health, including a large suicide problem we're seeing. At the same time, it means that they're not out on the streets getting in trouble and carousing with their friends. And so what may have been really bad for teen mental health may turn out to be positive with respect to crime.
Adam, to what degree does intense immigration enforcement play a role in this?
Yeah. It plays a role. There's just no denying it. It's a different conversation to say whether or not this big dragnet that has been placed over many cities is the right thing to do and is consistent with American traditions and values. It's a different question to say, but okay, out of the hundreds of thousands of people who have been removed from the communities, how many of them were actively involved in crime and had criminal histories or active criminal warrants for violent offending? And your colleagues at CBS News have done some of the definitive reporting on this and found that about 14% of those would meet that criteria. It's like a lot of people think that that's way too low, that that's pretty much everybody they should be targeting. But still at 14%, that is tens and tens of thousands of people who are involved in crime who have been taken off the streets.
Adam Gelb, President and CEO of the Council on Criminal Justice. It's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Next, Attorney General Todd Blanche refuses to say the Department of Justice will always act independently of the White House. Our political panel reacts to that and a lot more. That's next here on The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout and to The Takeout Tavern. You know, The Tavern is developing quite a reputation in Washington. And people ask me all the time, well, what are the Takeout Tavern days? And I've now come to a decision. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Takeout Tavern Day. So let me welcome our lucky panelists today, Democratic strategist, CBS News political contributor Joel Payne, and for the first time, Republican strategist, former chief of staff to Senator Marsha Blackburn, who just won a gubernatorial race primary in Tennessee, Chuck Flynn. Chuck, it's good to have you here.
Thanks, sir.
All right, I want to play for you both sound from Meet the Press yesterday, Todd Blanche, the attorney general, about the DOJ's independence. Listen.
The president does not expect any of his leaders, including me, to just say yes to him no matter what he says. And so, of course, there's vigorous back and forth with every cabinet member and the president of the United States, which is exactly what President Trump expects. And there again, there is this extraordinarily false narrative that the president wakes up in the morning and calls me and says, Todd, go prosecute X or Y. He does not do that. He has never done that. He will never do that.
He will never do that. You believe that?
I believe that as much as I believe I'm at Hawk and Dove right now up on Capitol
Hill. A lesser bar in Washington, D.C.
Yes, that's
not anywhere
right.
near the riz of the Takeout Tavern.
Todd Blanche is doing what every person who works for Donald Trump does, which is cape up for him in public and kind of tell a story and try to spin a story that's not reality. It's pretty obvious. I mean, even the things that he's answered, he's talked about how he actually does believe he's the president's attorney. He believes that he should be deferential to Donald Trump. I mean, he said that. And, you know, obviously the majority of or all Senate Republicans or the majority of them decided that that was the case. And
narrowly,
I think they're going to rue that day,
narrowly,
by the way. I think that's going to be a bad
thing. They narrowly confirmed him. Chuck, he has never done that and he never will do that. He might not have done that with Todd Blanche. He might have done it with the previous attorney general.
Look, Major, no attorney general, and this is a tired old narrative mm-hmm. we've seen in D.C. time and time again. I can remember when I was on the Hill, they were saying the same things about Bill Barr. No attorney general should have to pledge blanket independence from a president's priorities.
Because he was elected president.
Right, he was elected
president. Unitary executive.
Yeah, political interference is a different story if we're talking about that. But the administration has priorities.
Eric Holder was very tight with President Obama.
Eric Holder said he was President Obama's wingman, I seem to remember. And
John Mitchell was the campaign chairman for Richard Nixon's reelection campaign. That didn't turn out so well.
I think this is pretty historic, unprecedented, like, flagellation of the president by the attorney general. And I think that this is a different situation that we're in. And I think when you have an attorney general who is implicated in the Epstein files, who is implicated in the weaponization of government, I think that's where it's particularly troublesome. It's not just that he is that loyal to Donald Trump over his job as DOJ representative. It is that the things that he's done it for are pretty controversial and are hard for Republicans to defend.
Chuck.
I just think Democrats are always going to oppose whoever President Trump nominates. Two quick historical facts. William French Smith was Ronald Reagan's personal attorney for nearly two decades. He served as attorney general for four years.
After Ed Meese, yeah.
Right, that's correct, after Ed Meese. And then let's not forget, JFK appointed his brother. They had to come up with an anti-nepotism law after that. But I've seen this, you know, song and dance in Washington before. And just anyway.
All song and dances are different in the Trump administration. I think we can all agree on that. I want to play sound from James Blair, former very important White House aide, now on the outside helping with midterm strategy. This is what he said on Laura Trump's show on Fox over the weekend. Listen.
I feel like we have a very good chance to keep both the House and Senate and not only retain, but expand our majorities. Look, this election is really coming down to mainstream Republicans versus extreme liberal Democrats.
Chuck, I might put a note here, high on own supply. What do you think? I mean, honestly, that's pretty bold. Hold and expand under this atmospheric.
So the RCP average on the generic ballot
Real clear politics.
Has the Democrats up almost 7 points. I don't see a path for Republicans in the House. In the Senate,
to hold the majority.
Right, that's right. So I don't think Republicans are going to hold the majority in the House. The Senate, I think, is a different story. And I think that El Saeed winning the primary.
Abdul El Saeed in Michigan, right.
I think that's going to be a drag on the Democratic ticket. I think
there and maybe elsewhere or just
in,
there?
In elsewhere, because I think the Republicans are going to use him to campaign in other races. He won't disavow Hassan Piker, who said that America deserved 9/11. He's also got DSA ties, even though he's not DSA backed, Major.
Joel.
I think James Blair sounds like every staffer who, I mean, Chuck and I have both been staffers on the Hill. We would be expected to say that about our boss or about our political side. I agree with Chuck's assessment of the House. I'm a tad more bullish on the Senate. I don't think actually Abdul El Saeed is as much of a challenge as Republicans think he is. I think what's a challenge for Democrats is that this map, even under the best of circumstances, is a tough map for Democrats. And it's going to require Democrats, by the way, to expand the types of voters and the types of geographies that they're competitive in historically. And I think that's the challenge Democrats have.
So Mitch McConnell's still absent, still recovering, they say, though there's no evidence of it. He doesn't talk. He doesn't show himself. Andy Beshear was asked about this. He's the Democratic governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky on Face the Nation. Listen.
All he needs to do is call into this show for 2 minutes, or Fox News for 2 minutes, or do a video for 2 minutes to the people he's supposed to serve. But you know what? He absolutely refuses to do it. And then right. John Thune, as the leader of the Senate, you've got a duty to make sure all of your senators have the capacity to serve. And what is he saying? Not my job.
Chuck, how do you evaluate this?
Maximum transparency in these cases. I think that Mitch McConnell should be more transparent about this.
He doesn't even need to do 2 minutes on FaceTime. He could just do 30 seconds. That would answer a lot of basic questions if they are answerable.
How about not two staged photos from a hospital, okay? And look, this has been an issue. Tom Keene, Republican congressman, right. He missed almost 100 votes, 4 months of time. And it's not just elected officials, it's government officials. Remember Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. checked himself into a hospital for 2 weeks. The president and Congress didn't know about it for 4 days. So I'm just all for transparency in these cases.
I appreciate Chuck's perspective. I agree with it. I think it's, by the way, it's not a partisan problem. It's not just
but
Republicans
you
or Democrats.
But you gentlemen know yeah. the Senate dynamic, and you know senators don't
it's
want to divulge. They're clubby. There is a certain degree of entitlement here, and they just don't feel like they need to bow
Major,
to things like transparency.
One of the last times I was here, we talked about this. I think that these folks think that these seats belong to them, and I think that's why the American people have a harder and harder time trusting these public officials in these roles, is because they don't understand that this is a job. This is something that they have been granted responsibility from their constituents. This is not something that's bequeathed to you. You don't
Chuck,
own
what's
that
what's the harm
seat.
Of lack of transparency? People just continue to wonder.
It's trust in government. And that is everything. That is what this country is built on. It is a foundational principle. And look, we just saw Anthony Fauci go in front of Congress and plead the fifth 100 times. And whether you agreed with the response on COVID or not, a lot of people have problems when he's writing something down in a journal that's different than the public statements he's making. That also plays into a lot of things that are going on now. A lot of distrust in government.
It does go to trust. Joel Payne, Chuck Flynn. Chuck, great to have you here. Joel, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Well, nothing livens up life or text messages quite like an emoji. At least that's what my staff keeps telling me. But your choices, well, they very well might telegraph your age. Hello, Major. And say whether or not you're behind the times. Hello, Major. What is the hip way to convey laughter and a lot more? We'll try to find out on The Takeout. Look at all those emojis. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome back to the Conversation Corner. Well, emojis in the digital world express emotions in pictures, no words. New York Times did some digging and found that your choice in emojis, well, might give away your age and other demographic characteristics. Headline, do your emojis make you look old? Answer, when it's me, yes, 100%. Eve Washington from The New York Times joins me now. All right, Eve, I'm going to show you my top emojis, okay? I hope you can see them on the full screen. So let's bring them up, control room. Major's top emojis. So the first two are laughter, all right? The third one is, well, I grew up in San Diego. sunshine, sunglasses. That's always a state of mind for me. Fourth one, Shaka. I'm cool with that. That's all good. The two lower left hand, stuff's crazy in my life. Lots of things are crazy. The little one, no emotion. That's how I just like follow my mother's advice. If you don't have anything nice to say, say nothing at all. And then money, that's pure 1980s lingo. If I like it, it's money. That's it. That's my whole range of emoji life. Nothing more complicated than that. I think pretty confidently, Eve, that classifies me as a dead-end boomer with no hope attached.
You know, we didn't have boomers in our sample. They're not as active as a community on Reddit, but you're definitely aligned with the Gen Xers and in some cases the millennials, and nothing wrong with that. I think it's just fascinating how our emoji usage kind of like says a lot about like the ways that who we talk to and the ways that we use the internet.
Now, one other thing, on my text messages, I write in perfect, not perfect, but I write grammatical sentences. I use all proper capitalization. My kids rake me for that all the time. No text lingo at all. Everything is written out as if it were from a dictionary. That also gives away my age. But enough about me. Most popular emojis in 2025, Eve.
The most popular emoji in 2025 was the sobbing face emoji, followed up by the rolling on the floor laughing emoji, which I think was in one of your top threes, yep. And then the face emoji. And
so
some of these emojis.
What about the tears one? What does that signify? What does that mean?
It's kind of an all-purpose emoji, but it is like another way to say humor. It's like comes from the slang, I'm crying. Like, this is so funny that I'm like sobbing because of all of this emotion you brought out of me. But it can also mean sad. It can also mean just like dramatic. It's a little bit of an all-purpose emoji in that way.
How about the wilting rose?
The wilting rose is a really fun one. It's our fastest riser this year. And it also kind of serves a similar space as that crying emoji. It's like, I am rose. I am wilting. I am sad. It could be heartbreak. It could just be like something slightly inconvenient happened and like you feel despair because of it.
And when we think about emojis and the way they are invented and moved, as I read your story, teens are a big part of that, but teen girls are the biggest part of that. True?
Yeah. Teen girls are kind of in this like unique overlap where people who are kind of like more on the outside of society generally like innovate language more. They use language as a way of like signifying that they're part of a group and like creating a community around them. And also we see that like women have more like emotional language and that they deploy that even in spaces where like you can't literally talk. So teen girls kind of become this really unique overlap of people that were like natively online, kind of have that emotional vocabulary and are probably maybe a few steps back from like super mainstream culture and are finding unique ways to like make their presence known.
And very quickly, Eve, if an emoji gets to me, it's probably time to already put it out to pasture, right?
You know, you should keep using whatever works the best for you. But there are whole communities online who are dedicated towards making new emoji uses and keeping emojis unique and creating new memes that connect to them. So even if it's out of style for them, they're always coming up with something new down the pipeline.
There is always going to be something new in the emoji space. Eve Washington, I appreciate the research, appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Quick reminder, everyone, The Takeout is available as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and everywhere else. You can find each show there and our long-form interviews, of which we do many. Happy Monday, everyone. This is The Takeout, relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever. The Daily Report is next.